Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. If you're tuning into this podcast right now, you know that Democracy Now! Is news you can trust. Democracy Now! Is independent, which means we're funded by you, not the oil, gas, and coal companies when we cover climate change, or the weapons manufacturers when we cover war and peace, not the insurance industry when we cover health care. No, we're brought to you by viewers, listeners, readers like you, committed to independent information. Right now, a generous supporter will double your donation to Democracy Now! That means if you donate $15, we get $30. Take advantage of this generous offer and go to democracynow.org to make your donation today. Thank you so much. From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We have a human rights crisis at the U.S.-Mexico border. This is not the first time that had happened. In 7 months, we had 5 children that had died while in detention, and this is unacceptable. We're doing something wrong. The system is broken. Too many children had died because of the grim strategies at the U.S.-Mexico border.
For the 5th time since December, a Guatemalan child has died after being apprehended by Border Patrol. Before last year, it had been more than a decade since a child died in the custody of U.S. immigration officials. We'll get the latest. Then we look at the imprisonment of the leading feminist activist, Lujain Al-Haflul. She's been jailed for over a year in Saudi Arabia and has been reportedly tortured. For years, she led a movement to lift a ban on female drivers in Saudi Arabia. Tonight, she and 2 other imprisoned Saudi female activists are being honored with the 2019 Penn Freedom to Write Award. We'll speak with her brother and sister.
My sister is an activist in Saudi Arabia. She's been in prison for more than a year now. The first 10 months, she was tortured and imprisoned without any charges.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The UN's appealing to the U.S., Iran, and other involved parties to, quote, lower the rhetoric and lower the threshold of action as tensions flare between the U.S. and Iran. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, responded to what he called genocidal taunts from President Trump, warning him not to threaten the country after Trump tweeted Sunday, if Iran wants to fight, that will be the official end of Iran. Never threaten the United States again, Trump tweeted. Iran has repeatedly said it doesn't want war with the U.S. Zarif responded, quote, Iranians have stood tall for millennia while aggressors all gone. Try respect. It works, he said. Iranian state media reported Monday Iran has quadrupled its production of low-enriched uranium, but that it would still remain within the limits set by the 2015 nuclear deal. Tehran and other signatories to the deal are seeking to keep the landmark agreement alive after the U.S. withdrawal last year. Meanwhile, in Saudi Arabia, Yemen's Houthi rebels said Tuesday they launched another armed drone attack on an airport on the Saudi-Yemeni border. The attack comes a week after the Houthis claimed responsibility for coordinated drone attacks on a Saudi oil pipeline. The UN's warning food aid to Yemen could be suspended in war-torn areas controlled by Houthi fighters unless they abide by agreements to allow safe passage for aid delivery. The UN supplies food to over 10 million Yemenis who are at risk of famine due to the U.S.-backed Saudi-led war. In Texas, a 16-year-old Guatemalan teenage boy has died at a border patrol station in Weslaco, becoming the 5th known migrant child to die while in border patrol custody since December. Carlos Gregorio Hernandez Vasquez was arrested a week ago and was diagnosed with the flu while detained but was not hospitalized. Before last year, it had been more than a decade since a child died in the custody of U.S. immigration officials. We'll have more on this after headlines. On Capitol Hill, the standoff between President Trump and Democratic lawmakers over congressional subpoenas is set to intensify today as the House Judiciary Committee could hold former White House counsel Don McGahn in contempt for failing to appear in front of the panel today. McGahn said he would heed Trump's instructions to skip the hearing. The White House is arguing McGahn has constitutional immunity thanks to his former role as an immediate advisor to the president. The House panel subpoenaed McGahn to testify about possible presidential obstruction of justice during the Russia investigation. CNN is reporting that the House leadership, the Democratic leadership, debated last night whether to begin impeachment proceedings against the president. Meanwhile, D.C. District Judge Amit Mehta upheld a subpoena Monday for 10 years of Trump's financial records from the accounting firm Mazars, issued by the House Oversight Committee. Trump's lawyers attempted to resist the subpoena by arguing the request is unconstitutional because it isn't tied to legislation. Judge Mehta ruled the House panel had valid reasons for requesting the documents and that, quote, it's not for the court to question whether the committee these actions are truly motivated by political considerations, he said. Trump's lawyer said he would appeal the ruling. Federal prosecutors in New York are looking through tens of thousands of documents related to the funding of President Trump's inauguration for any evidence of illegal spending or campaign finance law violations, including whether any foreign donors received access to the Trump administration in exchange for inaugural contributions. A record-breaking $107 million in donations was received for Trump's inauguration. In New Zealand, police have charged the suspect in March's Christchurch massacre with terrorism. He's also facing 51 counts of murder and 40 counts of attempted murder. The 28-year-old Australian, Brenton Tarrant, is an avowed white supremacist who emailed out a racist manifesto minutes before he opened fire with an assault rifle at two mosques. He's scheduled to appear in court next month. In Indonesia, official results have confirmed the re-election of President Joko Jokowi Widodo. He defeated former Special Forces military commander Prabowo Subianto by 10 percentage points. However, Prabowo has rejected the final tally, alleging widespread cheating, and says he plans to challenge the results in court. Prabowo is the former son-in-law of Indonesia's longtime dictator Suharto and had made plans to stage mass arrests of political opponents and his current allies if he won. Another lawsuit has been filed against Boeing, alleging the company concealed known design flaws in its 737 MAX aircraft from airlines and the public. Mary Schiavo, the former inspector general for the U.S. Transportation Department, filed the lawsuit on behalf of a passenger who was killed in the March 10th crash of Ethiopian Airlines Flight 302, which killed all 157 people on board. The suit argues the Federal Aviation Administration handed over the bulk of its safety oversight to Boeing, allowing the company to rush through and cut corners on inspecting and certifying its own jets. In San Francisco, press freedom advocates are closely watching the case of journalist Brian Carmody, who is headed to court today to argue against the San Francisco police's widely denounced raid of his home and confiscation of personal devices earlier this month. The case relates to a leaked report involving the death of San Francisco public defender Jeff Adachi in February. Police are seeking information on how Carmody obtained the sealed police report, which described unflattering details about Adachi prior to his death, including the use of illicit drugs while with a woman who is not his wife. Carmody then sold the report to television stations. Jeff Adachi had long fought against police abuses, including racism within the ranks. Some of his supporters have said they suspect police deliberately leaked the report to damage Adachi's reputation. When police descended on Carmody's home, they reportedly used a sledgehammer on the front door and handcuffed him while they seized his computer, phone, and notebooks. Carmody's lawyers will ask the court to reverse police search warrants and return his personal goods immediately. Press freedom groups are also requesting the unsealing of the search warrant applications. In Dallas, Texas, Malaysia Booker, a 23-year-old black transgender woman, was found fatally shot over the weekend. Last month, a cell phone video of a crowd physically attacking Booker as she lay on the ground made headlines. Police say men in the video were shouting homophobic slurs at Booker, who eventually got away with the help of a group of women. Authorities say there is nothing connecting the perpetrator of last month's attack, Edward Thomas, to her shooting as of now. Malaysia Booker is the fourth known transgender person to be killed in the U.S. in 2019. According to the Human Rights Campaign, at least 26 transgender murders were recorded last year, although it's likely the actual number is higher. The majority of those were black transgender women. In the central United States, a series of intense storms brought flash flooding, baseball-size hail, and at least 19 tornadoes to parts of Missouri, Kansas, Oklahoma, and Texas Monday. Authorities canceled classes for 150,000 school children as heavy rains forced the closure of Interstate 40 and other highways, and emergency responders rescued people from flooded homes. A new scientific study finds that, left unchecked, climate change could increase sea levels worldwide by an average of as much as 6.5 feet by the end of the century. The report in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences finds the flooding could leave large swaths of coastal cities underwater by 2100, swamping hundreds of thousands of square miles of farmland and displacing more than 180 million people. In more climate news, The Guardian newspaper announced it's changing its style guide for terms describing climate events and phenomena. The Guardian's editor-in-chief said the changes are designed to better reflect the catastrophe for humanity we're facing. Editors and writers will replace the term climate change with climate emergency, climate crisis or climate breakdown, and global warming with global heating. Other updates include the word wildlife over the word biodiversity and climate science denier instead of climate skeptic. The Guardian also recently added a global carbon dioxide level report to its daily weather report. The Trump administration is planning to change how it counts the number of people killed by air pollution each year in a shift that would dramatically undercount premature deaths due to dirty air. The Environmental Protection Agency previously estimated Trump's move to roll back the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan would kill an additional 1,400 people per year due to inhalation of fine particulate matter, air pollution that's linked to heart attacks, strokes, and respiratory disease. But under the EPA's newly proposed analytical model, many of those deaths would no longer be counted. Pete Buttigieg, mayor of South Bend, Indiana, 2020 Democratic hopeful, appeared on a Fox News town hall Sunday in which he blasted the network and some of its most popular hosts. Speaking to host Chris Wallace, he explained why he decided to appear on the right-wing pro-Trump network.
When you see what goes on with some of the opinion hosts on this network, I mean, when you got Tucker Carlson saying that immigrants make America dirty, when you've got Laura Ingraham comparing detention centers with children in cages to summer camps, then there is a reason why anybody has to swallow hard and think twice before participating in this media ecosystem. But I also believe that even though some of those hosts are not always there in good faith, I think a lot of people tune into this network who do it in good faith. And there are a lot of Americans who my party can't blame if they are ignoring our message, because they will never hear it if we don't go on and talk about it.
Presidential candidate Buttigieg also called out Trump's tweets and attacks as grotesque, as well as what he called the media noise machine on the right wing. Several 2020 Democratic contenders have appeared on Fox recently in an effort to reach Trump voters. Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who drew the largest TV audience so far with 2.5 million people tuning in. New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is scheduled to appear on Fox for a town hall next month. President Trump took aim at Fox News for hosting Buttigieg. He accused the network of wasting airtime on Mayor Pete on Twitter Sunday and repeated his attacks Monday at a Pennsylvania rally, saying to his supporters, "What's going on with Fox, by the way? What's going on there? They're putting more Democrats on than you have Republicans." In more news from the 2020 campaign trail, California Senator Kamala Harris announced her proposal to close the gender pay gap Monday, which would hold companies liable if they fail to offer equal pay. This is Senator Harris speaking at a rally Sunday.
Women for the same work, for the equal work, on average make 80 cents on the dollar.
Under Harris's plan, companies with more than 100 employees would be required to submit data on staff compensation and could be penalized 1% of their daily profits for every 1% gap in pay between men and women. Profits from the fines would be used to invest in paid family and medical leave. Another Democratic hopeful, Washington State Governor Jay Inslee, unveiled last week the second part of an ambitious plan to tackle climate change as part of his 2020 platform. Inslee says his evergreen economy plan will invest $9 trillion over 10 years to create 8 million clean jobs that would also bolster unions, eliminate pay inequity, and ensure jobs for workers in the fossil fuel industry. It will also focus on building up renewable energy and environmental research, help upgrade buildings, and update water and transit infrastructure. Inslee previously pledged to make the U.S. carbon neutral by 2045. And in Florida, Sabrina Fulton, the mother of Trayvon Martin, is running for the seat of Miami-Dade County Commissioner. Fulton turned to activism after her son's murder in 2012, when the unarmed African-American teenager was shot and killed by a Neighborhood Watch vigilante, George Zimmerman, sparking nationwide protests. In addition to tackling gun violence, her platform also focuses on economic development and affordable housing. This is Sabrina Fulton speaking in her campaign video.
I didn't want to be the voice for Trayvon after he died, but I decided I have no choice. Now I'm called to act and called to serve. It became clear to me there's an opportunity to turn our family's tragedy into something positive for many other families. It took my son being shot down in order for me to stand up, but I'm standing now.
Again, Florida's Sabrina Fulton, the mother of Trayvon Martin, in her campaign ad as she runs for the seat of Miami-Dade County Commissioner. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today's show with yet another tragedy on the U.S.-Mexico border, where a 16-year-old Guatemalan boy died in U.S. custody Monday after spending a week in immigration jail. Carlos Gregorio Hernandez Vazquez died at a border patrol station at Westlaco, Texas, after being diagnosed with the flu. He was not hospitalized. This marks the fifth death of a Guatemalan child apprehended by Border Patrol since December. Before last year, it had been more than a decade since a child died in the custody of U.S. immigration officials.
Carlos Hernandez was arrested near the border in the South Rio Grande Valley May 13th and taken to a processing center in McAllen, Texas, where hundreds of migrants are held in large pens and forced to sleep on mats. U.S. law typically requires minors to be sent to facilities operated by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services within 3 days of being detained. But Carlos was held in McAllen for more than double that time. On Sunday, 6 days after he was first arrested, he reportedly was diagnosed with the flu after telling Border Patrol agents he was sick. Rather than hospitalize the 16-year-old, officials prescribed him Tamiflu and transferred him to another Border Patrol station in Westlaco. He was found dead the next morning.
The teenager's death comes less than a week after two-and-a-half-year-old boy whose family was apprehended at the U.S.-Mexico border in El Paso in April died on May 14th after spending weeks in the hospital with pneumonia and a high fever. 2 weeks before that, another 16-year-old, Juan de Leon Gutierrez, died after being apprehended by Border Patrol agents near El Paso. The Guatemalan Foreign Ministry said Gutierrez died of complications from an infection in his brain's frontal lobe. The spate of migrant child deaths began in December when 7-year-old Jacqueline Calmaquin died of a bacterial infection after being in Border Patrol custody. Soon after that, an eight-year-old boy, Felipe Gomez Alonso, died of a flu infection while in Border Patrol custody on Christmas Eve.
For more on the humanitarian crisis, we're joined by two guests. Here in New York, Fernando Garcia is with us, the founding director of the Border Network for Human Rights and Advocacy Group based in El Paso. And in Westlaco, Texas, we're joined by Jennifer Harberry on the telephone. She's a longtime human rights lawyer based in the Rio Grande Valley, along the U.S.-Mexico border, an activist with the Angry Tias. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Jennifer has a long history in Guatemala as well. But let's begin with Fernando Garcia. Your response to this latest death, the death of Fernanda, of Carlos, which follows the death of a 2.5-year-old. Which follows?
Well, thanks for having me. It's important to say that these are not circumstantial deaths. I mean, migrants are dying. Children are dying because of the way that the U.S. the U.S. administration, the Trump administration, is treating these refugees and asylum seekers. And it's not circumstantial because we had 5 deaths since December, but also in the whole year we had another one that happened in last May. So we have 6 children dying while in detention. The conditions that we had documented in detentions are horrific conditions. This is not the America that we know. I mean, we had children sleeping on the ground in the dirt with no access to water and medical attention, very limited medication and health care. I think we have a human rights crisis, not only a humanitarian crisis, a human rights crisis, because at the end of the day, the borders define the nation, the character of the nation. And what we have today, it is that children are dying because U.S. strategies.
Fernando, I wanted to read to you what the acting Customs and Border Patrol Commissioner John Sanders said in a statement. He said, quote, "The men and women of U.S. Customs and Border Protection are saddened by the tragic death of this young man, and our condolences are with his family. CPB is committed to the health, safety, and humane treatment of those in our custody." Your response to his statement?
You know, that is sure to be cynic. I mean, the situation on the ground doesn't reflect what they are saying in this statement. If they are shown a complete disregard of the lives and the rights of immigrants and refugees, let's remind ourselves, many of these families, many of these children are fleeing violent conditions in the country, economic depression, looking for a better life. And what they had found, it is, in this case, children dying at the border. And again, what we had documented is gross human rights violations in these detention centers.
I wanted to bring in Jennifer Harbury. You're there in Weslaco. You've been visiting some of the migrants and the refugees as they're being held in detention. What's your take on what's happening?
Well, I see a lot of the people in Reynosa, Mexico, where they're gathering, quote unquote, waiting their turn to cross. And then I see a lot of them when their families are being released to go north. Those are the ones who are crossing with children. And they have just been released from the Yalera. Literally, they've gone to the church refuge center to get a change of clothes and stuff and arrived at the bus station. And the difference in their health conditions is extraordinary. In Reynosa, they're exhausted, they're terrorized because they could be kidnapped or have been kidnapped at any moment. In northern Mexico, there's gunfights going on. But overall, they and their children are okay. Some of them have a stomach bug, some of them have colds. Couple of them have flu here and there, but overall, they're doing all right. By the time they come out of the Yalera, where I see them at people like them at the bus station not long thereafter, right, almost all of them are really sick with extreme respiratory problems because they're kept in holding cells with the AC cranked up so high and then given no blankets, just those Mylar ones, that they just literally are freezing for days on end. All of them are seriously sick. The children with diarrhea and also, like I say, severe respiratory problems from the cold.
And
but
Jennifer,
also they're all piled in.
Yolanda was Spanish for icebox. Where are you talking about these, as they're called, iceboxes are? And what do they look like inside?
Okay, I cannot go into the icebox. I see people just after they're released from the icebox. But the one that would be in our area is the notorious one at Ursula, just south of the city of McAllen.
So it's in the United States. It's on the U.S. side of the border.
That's right. So people come across from Reynosa, where they have gathered at the shelter, and conditions are really rough, but they're okay. By the time the Yalera on the U.S. side gets through with holding them for a few days, they're really sick. And I've had, like, a mom with her child just recovering from chicken pox, and she said, yeah, you know, we got it in there, and they kept us all together in the sleeping area. We're piled all in on top of each other. and they didn't take us to a clinic. Extreme diarrhea, you don't get take. There's basically no medical care. So by the time they come out, they're really sick, and it's almost too late. So we have cases like this tragedy of the person who got sent on from there exactly up to the Wessico Processing Center and just abandoned in a room somewhere because he couldn't be held with the adults.
And Jennifer, the
yeah.
fact that so many of those who have died have been Guatemalan, because obviously people are coming over from Honduras and Salvador as well,
yes.
and the particular impact, especially to you with your long history in terms of the Guatemalan popular movement there, your reaction to that as well.
I'm not sure what the cause of that is, and I certainly do want to find out. I think part of it is the extreme lack of resources of anyone from Guatemala in making their way north. It was probably just a much rougher trip. They were exposed to the conditions and probably were much more exhausted by the time they got here. And then were tossed into these rooms or dormitories or pig pens or whichever you would like to call them, without any medical protection or care. People are sleeping on the floor, packed in. And so they all get everything from each other and more caused by the cold.
Fernando Garcia, you're nodding your head as Jennifer is down there in Wessico talking about that mm-hmm. area where Carlos just died. What is the legality of this? Children in ice boxes, in freezing boxes, how long are they being held for?
You know, they're supposed to be, I mean, children, specific children, they're supposed to be held only for 72 hours in this the Border Patrol or ICE detention centers. And then after that, they should be either released or transferred. But that is not necessarily happening. I mean, in the case of Carlos Gregorio, he was held by Border Patrol for 7 days. They cannot wash their hands and say that they didn't know anything that happened in those 7 days. I mean, that is ridiculous. What we are seeing is a complete lack of accountability and oversight of these institutions. I think the standards that they are acting, they are not only violating human rights, but also the U.S. U.S. Constitution. I mean, they are clearly buying into this rhetoric that immigrants are rapists, criminals, and this xenophobic sentiment. I think that is the reason why there are this treatment that they are going through in the detention centers.
And what kind of access do civil society organizations or local governments or even members of Congress have to be able to get into these detention centers and ascertain for themselves what's happening?
Well, we don't have access. I mean, and that actually became very clear after Trump got elected. In the past, we had very good relations with local Border Patrol stations and ICE officers. After Trump was elected, we saw a number of things happening. The Tornillo case, where we had like children being separated from their mothers, and we didn't have access to that. Now there are other detention centers being built. The Yeleras, the ice boxes, they have at least one in every detention center, in every processing center. And sometimes they're being used to punish people. If they misbehave, they will send them to the Yeleras. So we don't have access. We had requested many times to go and observe what is the situation that these children, these families are going through, and it's very limited. I mean, it seems that they are hiding something. And what they are hiding is these conditions that are leading up to all of these children dying.
Senator Lindsey Graham has introduced a bill that would deny people the right to seek asylum at the U.S.-Mexico border, forcing them instead to take their claims to U.S. consulates in their home countries, even if their lives are in danger. Graham's bill would also increase the number of days that migrant children could be detained to 100, five times the current limit. Fernando, your response?
No, you know, I think this is part of a larger vision or a larger agenda that is being applied at the border. They are not only don't want more legal immigrants coming into the country, but they are strengthening the militarization of the border. Do we have more military police officers, Border Patrol, like never before? I think we have one of the most militarized areas. And even in those conditions, They still want to reject asylum seekers. And I think at the end of the day, they are going against American history. Let's remind ourselves that many people came from other countries because of the same conditions. Europeans came to the United States through Ellis Island because they were fleeing violence. It seems that what Trump administration is going against history and against our American values.
We're going to talk more about that in a minute, but we have to break. Fernando Garcia, founding director of the Border Network for Human Rights, is joining us in studio, usually in El Paso. And Jennifer Harbury is with us, longtime human rights lawyer based in the Rio Grande Valley, speaking to us from Weslaco. This is Democracy Now! After that, we will be speaking with a brother and sister of the leading Saudi feminist human rights activist who's been jailed for more than a year. They and she say that she has been tortured in a Saudi prison. Stay with us.
Money is the only thing he has. Money is the only thing he
Sam Phillips. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Our guests are Jennifer Harbury of the Angry Tias, speaking to us from Weslaco, Texas. That's where another Guatemalan child was found dead in U.S. border custody. We're also joined in studio by Fernando Garcia, founding director of the Border Network for Human Rights based in El Paso.
Fernando, I wanted to ask you about the President Trump's threats to send the refugee applicants who are in detention into sanctuary cities as a sort of as a payback for the to the sanctuary cities for their rebellion against federal policy. I'm wondering your thoughts about that.
Yeah, it seems like that's a way to punish what they quote unquote punished those cities that actually had welcomed immigrants, had embraced immigrants and immigration. And I think that is very horrific. And I mean, because what they are trying to do is to create this sense of crisis that doesn't exist. At the end of the day, the so-called national security crisis is not happening. What they are trying to say to do, and what they are trying to say is that these immigrants represent a threat to the United States, and they are. That's why they are releasing more immigrants in Phoenix, in Arizona, or in California, San Diego, in other countries that they have not seen immigration influx, and they want to actually make a case by releasing immigrants in these so-called sanctuary cities. But I think this is not going to work. What we had seen in most of the cities, including El Paso and all along the border, is people in communities are welcoming these immigrants because this is what we are. This run in our veins. We're a nation of immigrants at the end of the day, and I think there's no way that we can erase that.
Jennifer Harbury, you have a long history with Guatemala. You were married to a man who was a Mayan comandante, disappeared. You fought for a long time to have his whereabouts known. You learned he was tortured and murdered by U.S.-backed Guatemalan military. That was back in the 80s. How do you relate what has happened there then, and the massive number of deaths estimated at, what, up to 300,000 people killed in Guatemala through the 80s into the 90s, with what is happening with the exodus of Guatemalans today?
I think there's a definite relationship. For one, of course, the United States worked absolutely hand in glove throughout the war with the Army. On all of the genocidal campaigns and stuff, we were literally sending CIA people to joint planning sessions. But what really stands out is the fact that so many of the high-level Guatemalan intelligence leaders of that era Who were trained in the School of the Americas and who served as CIA paid informants, also had slowly but surely become involved in the drug trade, and after the war rose to the top and started their own cartels. One of my husband's killers, Julio Roberto Alpiras, is exactly such a person. The DEA has him on their corrupt officer list, but they cannot go after him because he's a former CIA contact. One of our former partners, therefore he's off limits. So we created these Frankensteins. We trained them, we taught them torture techniques, we funded them, and we armed them. They don't much need our money anymore, and they're devouring the country using the same techniques of torture and terror that they used before. Once again, everyone's roaring north. Could we stop the true cause, which is them? We could, but we won't. We're not releasing files that would put them in jail. We still have relationships with the Army that one by one keep showing up as being extremely involved in the gangs. We keep supporting the Frankenstein family, as I'll call it. Those are what the people that are driving the hundreds of thousands of people north. No one can survive there anymore. And we wouldn't stay there with our children for 1 minute. So, yes, there's a relationship. It's the same people, and we're once again standing back and letting them do it.
So, Jennifer, what you're saying is that after the peace accords and the supposed establishment of civilian governments in several of these Central American countries, that nothing fundamentally has changed in terms of how of the conditions of the people, whether it's in Guatemala, Salvador, or Honduras?
You know, I won't say that in Guatemala there's 300 people being killed every afternoon. Those massacres are not occurring. But, yes, are the mining companies burning villages down and driving leaders into hiding and stuff just like before? Yes, it is going on still. There's been no true change in the structure. We've got people thrown into jail at the highest levels of the Guatemalan government, for example. And not long ago, one of the key candidates for president was arrested in Florida for trying to get the local cartel leaders to fund his campaign and also shoot his opponents. So the actual structure of the government in all these countries has turned to rubble. The army leaders that carried out the worst of the dirty wars are still in de facto power, and now they're the cartels.
I wanted to get your response, Fernando, to the Jared Kushner immigration plan, the New York developer, the son-in-law of President Trump, who's come up with an immigration plan. I wanted to talk about what happened last week. I mean, last week, the Trump administration unveiled this new plan for a so-called merit-based immigration system that would prioritize highly skilled English-speaking workers while further restricting asylum seekers and immigrants who have family living in the U.S., many lawmakers calling Trump's immigration plan short on specifics and a non-starter. This is Washington Democratic Congressmember Pramila Jayapal responding.
It does not include any protections for Dreamers. It does not include any plan for the 11 million undocumented immigrants that are in this country that need a path to citizenship. It undermines the family immigration system that has been the cornerstone of our country's immigration policy.
So that's Washington Congressmember Pramila Jayapal. Your response, Fernando?
Well, clearly this is a political stunt. I mean, I guess the president is trying to energize his base towards the 2020 election. This plan doesn't have any future of passing. I mean, whether it might have a chance in the Senate, which I doubt it. Not even Republicans support this plan. But also Democrats actually clearly rejected these plans by the same reasons why Pramila was mentioning, which is what is not containing, doesn't contain a solution for the 11 million people, for Dreamers, for DACA recipients. I think this is not going anywhere.
Well, the New York Times reported today, quote, access to a government jet 24 hours a day, an office in the West Wing, plus guaranteed weekends off for family time, and an assurance of being made Secretary of Homeland Security by November. Those were among a list of 10 conditions that Kris Kobach, the former Kansas Secretary of State, has given to the White House if he is to become the administration's immigration czar, a job President Trump has been looking to create to coordinate immigration policy across government agencies. Your reaction, Fernando, to the possibility of Kris Kobach becoming the immigration czar of America, of the United States?
It's just one thing after the other. You know, I was listening to this story of this Salvadorian refugee that was in the plane with me coming to New York, And she was telling me, again, another testimony of the conditions in detention. They don't have water. They don't have milk for the children. They don't have medicine and medications. They don't have basic services that they need. And in those conditions, now we are willing to spend money in other stuff and not really taking care of children in detention. I think those, it just reflects how how the priorities of this administration are set up. I mean, instead of releasing these children, we're building walls, very expensive walls. And I think this just follows the same pattern.
We want to thank you both for being with us. Fernando Garcia, founding director of the Border Network for Human Rights, based in El Paso. And Jennifer Harbor, a longtime human rights lawyer based in the Rio Grande Valley along the U.S.-Mexico border, also an activist with the Angry Tears. When we come back, we look at the imprisonment of the leading Saudi feminist activist, Lujain al-Hadloul. She's been jailed for more than a year for leading a movement to lift a ban on female drivers in Saudi Arabia. We'll speak with her brother and sister. Stay with us. Running with the Sun by Nora B. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to Saudi Arabia's jailing of female activists who have challenged one of the world's most misogynistic governments. It was a year ago this month, on May 15, 2018, when Saudi authorities arrested Lujain al-Hadloul and four other women. They were accused of undermining national security. She has been held ever since. Born in 1989, Lujain is an icon of the Saudi women's rights movement. For years, she led a movement to lift the ban on female drivers in Saudi Arabia and to overhaul the kingdom's male guardianship system. In 2014, she was arrested after attempting to drive from the United Arab Emirates to Saudi Arabia. A video of her driving went viral.
Hello, I'm Lucien Akhalul. I'm on the Quaifa Highway. I'm going to try to cross the Saudi borders. I'm driving a car I own, and I have a United Arab Emirates driving license in an attempt to continue the women driving campaign. Let's see what happens.
In 2015, Lujain attempted to run in the first municipal election open to female candidates, but she was subsequently disqualified. Despite multiple arrests, Lujain continued to speak out for women in Saudi Arabia. She was arrested again May 15, 2018, as part of a broader crackdown on female activists and critics of the Saudi government. According to human rights groups, she has since been held in solitary confinement, been subjected to abuse, including electric shocks, flogging, and threats of sexual violence. The Saudi government's resisted calls from human rights groups and lawmakers from around the world to release Lujain and the other activists. Tonight, Lujain Al-Havlul is being honored with the 2019 Penn Barbie Freedom to Write Award, along with two other imprisoned Saudi female activists, Nouf Abdulaziz and Iman Al-Nafjan. Lujain was also recently included on the Time 100 list recognizing the world's most influential people. We're joined right now by Lujain's brother and sister, Waleed and Lina Al-Havlul, who are in New York to accept the Penn Award on behalf of their sister. Lina, thank you very much for joining us. Talk about what Lina is facing in jail, what you understand Lujain is going through right now.
So there have been different periods since her arrest. So she was arrested in May 2018. So from May 2018 till August 2018, we weren't allowed to have any visits. And so starting from August, my parents could see her once a month. So from August till December, she was in prison in Jeddah. And during this period where we weren't allowed to have any visits, she has been tortured. As you said, she has been flogged, she has been electrocuted, she has been sexually harassed, she has been deprived of sleep. And that was the period where she was in a secret prison. And when they allowed for the visits, she was back in the normal prison. In December, she was flown back to Riyadh, the capital of Saudi Arabia, where my parents live. And starting from December, January, it was again the one visit per month. In March, they announced that there was going to be a trial. So that's when she found out the charges. So for almost a year, she didn't know what the charges were. So now she's still in prison. She's facing a trial, but the trial is really not transparent because we don't know when the next session is. We don't know how everything is going to be processed. So she's just waiting endlessly. Yeah.
And Waleed, in terms of the charges against her, what is the government accusing her of doing?
So typically, before her arrest, local media was saying that, local media that is semi-government and to some extent owned by the government. Typically, they were saying that she was accused of being associated with foreign entities. We don't know who these entities are. They haven't specified them. Working as a spy, basically, getting finance from foreign entities and undermining state security. When the trial started, we didn't know exactly what the official charges were at that time. But when on the first session of the trial, which was on March 13, when we saw the list of charges, really, there is nothing that says that she was, being a spy or she was being financed by foreign entities. There is a document that is a fake document that is being, circulated on Twitter and social media, saying that she received a check of 9 million Qatari riyals. I believe it's around 2 million U.S. dollars. they are showing that she got that, but on the official list of charges, really nothing that says that. Like, most of the charges, like, are related to her human rights activism, like, you know, having contacts with Human Rights Watch, having contacts with Amnesty International, like having contacts with foreign accredited foreign journalists in Saudi Arabia, and even one of the charges is actually applying for a job at the United Nations. So clearly, there is nothing that says that is actually backing these allegations that started when she was first arrested.
Can you talk about who, Lena, can you talk about who Saud al-Qahtani is, one of the top advisors to the Crown Prince, and what is he doing in this jail with your sister?
So officially, I don't think he has any power anymore. But what we have been hearing is that before all of the Saudi affairs, he was a consultant in the royal court. And so he was one of the people who were welcoming Loujain when she arrived in Jeddah, when she was transferred the first time when she got arrested. And when she arrived in Jeddah, he asked her, would she prefer 20 years of imprisonment or the death penalty? So that was the first time she saw him. And then, so during the torture sessions, she told us that he was part of these torture sessions and that he was the one ordering it and that he was clearly laughing at her and mostly enjoying these times.
Was he threatening her with rape?
Yes, he did. He was threatening her with rape and murder. And he even said that if he wants it, he can even make her body disappear in the sewage system.
Was she waterboarded?
Yes, she was. She was waterboarded, she was sexually harassed, she was flogged, she has been electrocuted, she has been deprived of sleep, she has been forced to eat till she couldn't accept it anymore.
I wanted to ask you, in her years of activism, I'm wondering the conversations you had with her in terms of her insistence that she had to stand up in a society that is so repressive of women, and what kinds of conversations you had about what drove her to take this courageous stand.
I mean, Jane has always been very brave and courageous, and she has always hated injustice, and she has always told us that it has been because they always tell her, slow down, it's going to happen, don't force things. And she's always been saying, it's been 20 years that we've been silent, and women still can't drive, women still can't are considered as child there till their death. So I don't want to wait anymore, and things have to happen and we have to act. So she was really convinced that acting was the right thing.
I want to go to your sister. I want to go to Loujain al-Hafloul. In her own words, in 2016, she and her husband were interviewed by Nick Pelham of The Economist magazine.
And what difference would it make to your own lives if you could drive, if your wife could drive? Would your life fundamentally change? Is it such a huge issue for you?
It's a constant issue that I face every day, and not only once a day, like emotionally too, because we fight a lot because of that issue. Like, who's going to drive me around? Who's going to take me? And just to beg people to take me around is insulting enough. For the financial part also, it does affect a lot. It takes a good 30% to 40% of my salary sometimes to pay for drivers, just to take me to the necessary things, the necessary places, like home to work, work to home.
That is Loujain al-Hafloul. She has been imprisoned for a year now, just over a year. According to U.S. intelligence officials, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has sanctioned an operation to carry out a secret campaign against dissidents. The missions were carried out by what U.S. officials call the Saudi Rapid Intervention Group, whose members appear to have been involved in the torture and killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The group also seems to have been involved in the detention and abuse of more than a dozen Saudi women's rights activists who campaigned against the ban on driving by women, including Loujain. Can either of you talk about this force? Do you know about it?
No, I don't understand that.
And let me ask you on the driving issue. Is it true that when the Crown Prince announced that women would have limited access, they would be able to drive, that at the same time the world was hailing him as a great forward-thinking leader, he was arresting the very driving activists like your sister who had fought for this for so long, telling them they should not tweet, they should not comment on Saudi Arabia ending the ban on driving? Can you explain what this was all about?
Yes, so before the announcement, all of the activists have been told not to comment anything. And at the very beginning, we really thought it was a good thing, because maybe in a society that's a bit traditional, etc., maybe it's the good thing to do, to calm down the people who are against it and who are not used to changes. So we really thought, okay, it's okay, we won't comment anything, just make it happen, because what we want is change. And so we didn't. They didn't comment anything. And when we saw that afterwards, even they stayed silent, but they got arrested, they got tortured. So we now changed our vision, and we really think it wasn't maybe the right thing to do to be silent from the beginning.
And Walid, I wanted to ask you, both you and your sister now live abroad, obviously not in Saudi Arabia. Do you have concerns yourself about the reach of the Saudi authorities to those who speak out, even if they're not in the country?
To some extent, yes, but I'm taking my, I'm being very cautious in terms of, my movements and where I go, where, also how to communicate. I do have some concerns, but so far I have not been, I haven't received any direct threats. But I do have, I do receive like threats on social media, but that's not a direct threat to me. I do have that kind of concern, because we have seen people who were targeted abroad, and I fear that this could happen to me as well.
And your parents are still in Saudi Arabia. How are they faring, and how often do they get to speak to your sister?
They speak with my sister like every Sunday, but I have like limited contacts with them, because we can't really reach them on a daily basis, if we can put it that way. Yeah, so we have really limited communications with them.
At a gala dinner last month honoring Time's list of the world's 100 most influential people, the comedian Hassan Minhaj called for the release of Loujain. Minhaj also called out Jared Kushner, who was at the gala, over his close relationship with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
I know there's a lot of very powerful people here, and it'd be crazy if, I don't know, if there was just like a, I don't know, like if there was like a high-ranking official in the White House that could WhatsApp MBS and say, hey, maybe you could help that person get out of prison because they don't deserve it. But that'd be crazy. That person would have to be in the room, but it's just a good comedy premise.
That's Hassan Minhaj speaking at the Time 100 event where Jared Kushner was. And he was talking about freeing your sister. What do you want Jared Kushner, President Trump, to do?
So we're speaking for things to change. So whoever has the power to do something about it, we really wish they would act and ask for her release. And that's what all we want, is our sister to be free. So whoever has the power.
And the importance of tonight's, your sister being honored by Penn?
And that's really great. I think that a recognition, even for Loujain, I mean, it gives her so much more, knowing that she's supported gives her, she breathes a bit of freedom while in jail, knowing that she's supported. And I think it's really important for her to stay strong. And for us also, I mean, we're a bit weak sometimes, because we feel like we don't have any power in our hands to change things. But knowing that people are being supportive is really good, yeah.
Can you comment very quickly on the two women who are also being honored along with your sister, Nouf Abdulaziz and Iman al-Nafjan, also Saudi feminist activists in prison?
Yes, I think it's really great that it's not only Loujain, that other women who are maybe a bit less internationally known are also awarded because they have fought as much as Lujain, and they also deserve it, yes. And I'm really proud of them as well, yeah.
Jared Kushner is sometimes referred to as the, the two of them, MBS and Jared Kushner, the Crown Prince and the Clown Prince. What do you think of their close relationship? It's almost seen as the Crown Prince whisperer just recently went there to Saudi Arabia to meet with him yet again, even after the murder of Khashoggi, the Washington Post columnist.
But to be honest, I'm not very political, so all I know is really my sister's story, and I can't comment something I really don't know anything about.
So. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Lena and Waleed Al-Hathloul, sister and brother of the jailed Saudi activist Lujain. She has been imprisoned in Saudi Arabia for more than a year for her fearless advocacy for women's rights. Happy birthday to Tamarie Astidio. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Gezder, Nermeen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.